Good evening, everyone. My name is Ayça Çubukçu. I'm an assistant professor in human rights at the London School of Economics and Political Science. On behalf of the Center for the Study of Human Rights at the LSE, I'm delighted to welcome you this evening to the school and introduce our speaker tonight, Dr. Avol Allo. For many of you tonight, Dr. Allo will need no introduction. Nevertheless, allow me to note that he is a LSE Fellow in Human Rights at the Center for the Study of Human Rights at LSE and at the Department of Sociology. Prior to joining LSE, Dr. Allo was the Lord Kelvin Adam Smith Fellow at the University of Glasgow. He holds degrees from Addis Ababa University, University of Notre Dame in the United States, and the University of Glasgow. Dr. Allo's research interests are in the areas of the sociology of law, critical social theory, political theory, human rights, postcolonial studies, and the African Union. Dr. Allo is interested in understanding and explaining how law constitutes and regulates the social world by observing how its discourses, practices, and institutions operate in the real world and generate certain effects. Dr. Allo has a forthcoming book, which will be out next year, called Law and Resistance Toward a Performative Epistemology of the Political Trial. He is also the co-editor of the collection, the editor book, The Courtroom as Space of Resistance, Reflections on the Legacy of the Rivonia Trial. Dr. Allo's lecture this evening is titled Competing Nationalisms in Ethiopia, The Case for Transnational Solidarity, and it is hosted by the Internationalism, Cosmopolitanism, and Politics of Solidarity Research Group that I convene at LSE. Tonight, Dr. Allo will speak for about 15 minutes, and we will leave plenty of time for questions and answers. The event is going to end around 8 p.m. It's a tremendous pleasure and honor, indeed, to present Dr. Allo, who is an extraordinary scholar, a public intellectual, a fantastic colleague, and dear friend. Dr. Allo.
Thank you, Dr. Kibuktu, for that very generous, very kind introduction. You've always been very kind to me, and I think I'm going to miss that. Thanks also for everyone else, my students, past and present, who are here. Thanks for coming, and everybody else, thanks for coming. The title of my talk this evening is Competing Nationalisms in Ethiopia, the Case for Transnational Solidarity. So as you can imagine, nationalism is one of the most contentious issues in any organized political communities, within any organized normative political communities, and Ethiopia is no different in that case. And in fact, within Ethiopia, there are certain things that particularly make a discussion, conversations about nationalisms very, very difficult. And precisely because of that, I want to preface my presentation with few remarks. The first is about my own scholarly location. As Ayça said, I am a legal scholar. I'm not a scholar of nationalism or a historian. But over the course of the last 7-8 years, precisely because of the significance of these issues, these themes within Ethiopian political discourse, I have been engaging with these things, I have been observing these issues, and I have been reading around these issues. And I hope to be able to defend some of the very limited claims that I will be making in my presentation tonight, regardless of the fact that I am a legal scholar. The other point is that some of, or at least the conundrum that I am going to present tonight is a conundrum in which many people, including many people in this room, would have a significant stake. Precisely because of that reason, a number of you might hold some very core beliefs about these views, very strong beliefs about these views. And it is possible that you might find some of what I have to say, my accounts of these themes, somewhat offensive, disingenuous, wrong-headed, stupid, even worse. And I think that is okay. Fanon sort of brilliantly captured this phenomenon when he wrote in Black Skin, White Masks the following. And I think it's a particularly illuminating quote for the Ethiopian context, and I wanted to just share it at this early point. And he says, sometimes people hold a core belief that is very strong. When they are presented with evidence that works against that belief, the new evidence cannot be accepted. It will create a feeling that is extremely uncomfortable, called cognitive dissonance. And because it is so important to protect the core belief, they will rationalize, ignore, and even deny anything that doesn't fit in with the core belief. So I fully understand if you are to feel uncomfortable with some of the things that I have to say. But that is, in a way, my point. My goal, of course, is not to offend you, but I think in order for us to overcome these difficulties of having exchange and discussion that leads to some kind of understanding, it's important that we get somewhat uncomfortable. The kind of optimism that you see on the ground at the moment, the desire for people to come together across political spectrums, to speak in one voice, to protest together, to mourn together and grieve together, is not so much an expression of shared vision, but it is an expression of shared grievances. Okay. And shared grievances are not sufficient in of themselves for us to overcome this unprecedented challenge that we face as a society. So if I happen to go on some of these themes very hard, if you think I am being harsh on some of these ideas, just remember that I am not trying to annihilate them or I'm not trying to destroy them. I'm trying to open them up. I'm trying to sort of grasp and understand the constitutive and regulative power of these discourses, such as Ethiopianet or Oromuma or Oromones, for example. I'm trying to make them more inclusive, more egalitarian, more fair. Because these discourses are so powerful in terms of animating and informing the ways in which our conversations shape up. So that is sort of long preface to my presentation. Okay. And the paper emerged out of a set of concerns around authoritarianism and state violence in Ethiopia, particularly the conditions of possibility for these authoritarian states. The things that made it possible for a minority regime in Ethiopia to secure and consolidate an authoritarian system that is both violent and resilient at the same time. And I'm sure there can be multiple explanations as to what made this authoritarian system to thrive for a period of 25 years. But I'm going to suggest that it is antagonism between the Oromos and Amharas, the two largest ethnic groups in Ethiopia that make up close to 75% of Ethiopia's 100 million people, which explains the consolidation of an authoritarian system that we have in Ethiopia. It is possible to come up with explanations such as Western support, the ways in which the ruling party skillfully, strategically appropriated and used the discourse around war on terror, all of those things. But I think these are not standalone, independent explanations. They are extensions of that policy of divide and rule upon which the current regime thrives. So that is, can you hear me at the back?
Yeah.
So that is basically what provides the raw material for the system. So let me just tell you a little bit about this antagonism that I'm talking about between the Oromos and Amharas, how it came into being and how it is currently used to sustain this oppressive system. This antagonism between the two people is very well known. In his book, Greater Ethiopia, sociologist Donald Levine tells us how Greater Ethiopia pursued a policy of ethnic homogenization in which Amhara identity become the identity and culture par excellence, essentially pushing other identities and cultures to the periphery of the country's social and cultural life. Levine presents Amharas and Oromos as the two great historical antagonists of the Ethiopian state. In a memorable formulation, he says, contemporary Ethiopia is an Amhara thesis and an Oromo antithesis. And this compelling dialectical description of the two great historical antagonists, Oromo and Amhara, I think is a powerful illustration of the divergent experiences of the two groups and their contemporary intransigence. Despite being the largest ethno-national group in the country, for example, Oromos were not treated as equal partners historically and did not have an influence that is commensurate with their demographics and with their contribution to the economy of the country. And these asymmetries and inequalities between Oromos and Amharas helped to fuel and perpetuate this antagonism, which made conversation, exchange, dialogue between the two groups absolutely impossible. So the current regime under the Tigray People Liberation Front, this is a political party that purports to represent the Tigray people from northern part of Ethiopia. The Tigray people are about 6% of the Ethiopian population. And this group effectively appropriated, used this antagonism between the two larger groups to establish itself as a dominant political force in the country. So long-standing Oromo questions for genuine self-determination and injustice have been systematically misrepresented as somewhat extremist, narrow-minded secessionist. The Oromo question became the quintessential Ethiopian problem, and Oromos came to be seen as the most significant threat to Ethiopia's unity and territorial integrity. This is in a country in which Oromos constitute the majority. So if you get to shape the discourse, then everything is possible. At the same time, the Amharas, who are the largest, second largest ethnic group in the country, were disparaged as violent and chauvinists, as people who seek to resurrect the old feudal medieval system. So within this narrative frame, TPLF becomes the only moderate centrist force that can secure Ethiopia's sovereignty and territorial integrity from the secessionist threat of the Oromos and from the far-right extremism of the Amharas. And my point here is that the antagonism between these two largest groups in Ethiopia is currently facilitating a specific form of divide and rule. Okay. And both parties are actually playing into the hands of the regime. So they are helping the policy of divide and rule to actually function. And this is the concern that animates this paper. Two competing forms of nationalisms, Ethiopianness, Ethiopian nationalism, and Oromoness, Oromo nationalism, are nationalisms that garnered powerful and eloquent theoretical endorsements of their own. And these are central to understanding this antagonism between the Oromos and the Amharas. Most of these articulations and endorsements present a highly essentialist account of both Ethiopianness and Oromoness. They posit themselves as notions with some kind of self-evident truths, notions with their own inner reality and a stable foundation. My point is that any proposal for a democratic and representative alternative or a future vision in Ethiopia must take seriously the kinds of thought, the forms of rationality, ways of reasoning that structures and organizes conversations and debate between Amharas and Oromos. So what I hope to do in the rest of the paper is to argue a case for transnational solidarity and suggest a few ideas that will form sort of preliminary basis, right, for a kind of solidarity that insists on the strength of weak ties. So I'm not talking about unity, not talking about oneness. I'm talking about a form of solidarity that insists on the strength of weak ties. So to do that, I want to begin by critiquing both Ethiopianness and Oromoness with a view to exposing the contingency and complexity underneath both of these discourses. And my aim in doing this is to describe and explain how these notions come to have the kinds of political reality they seem to have, and their role in sustaining and enabling the current system. I'm also interested in pointing out the centrality of TPLF's policy of divide and rule on the form and the content of this antagonism. So the point is not that this antagonism is completely created by existing regime, but the contemporary manifestation of this antagonism is very much transformed and reconfigured in a particular way, in ways that allows the current system to become durable and resilient. So let me just say some very general points about nationalism, and then I will try and zoom in. Nationalism played the single most important role in the triumph of anti-colonial struggles in Africa and Asia. Nationalist thoughts and frameworks provided native leaders with normative language and ethical framework for articulating the lofty aims of national emancipation from colonial subjugation. It essentially provided the fuel for legitimizing and sustaining belligerent sentiments towards colonial powers and their infrastructure. Nationalist constructions of history and memory and their understandings of politics and society in this period privilege the nation as an infallible, eternal, and transcendent category. For the nationalist, the nation is not just prior to the state, it's a cultural construct. It's a cultural construct that transcends time and transience. So the legacies of nationalist thoughts and their worldviews still reverberate around the post-colonial African states in waves that could bring many of these states to their knees. Unlike the colonial period, however, nationalist forms of mobilizations within ethnically diverse post-colonial African states precipitated conditions for adversarial nationalisms in which ethnicity functioned as the overriding determinant of political action, behavior, and decision. In many post-colonial African states, nationalism is a vital factor of intractability, inhibiting constructive dialogue and configuring history and collective memory along binary lines. And such is the story of two competing nationalisms in Ethiopia, namely Ethiopian nationalism, Ethiopianism, or Ethiopiawinet in Amharic, Oromo nationalism, or Oromoness. So what are these things that we call Ethiopiawinet or Oromuma, Oromones? How do they come into being? Certainly they are not questions of blood and flesh, at least within the framework that I am thinking about these things. So in what do Ethiopianness and Oromones consist? What is their politics of truth? How do we as individuals and groups come to know the things that we know about Ethiopianness and Oromones? How do these terms come to have the kinds of political investment and truth claims that they seem to have? What is the relationship between Ethiopia, the concrete territorial entity that has a fixed geographic existence, our knowledge of it, in some cases a very divine, sacrosanct idea of what Ethiopia is, and in some cases extremely critical of what it is. Those who are critical of the Ethiopian vision of nationalism are not as critical when it comes to, for example, what Oromuma is or what Oromoness is. They probably have exactly the same kind of orientation towards Oromoness that pan-Ethiopian nationalists have towards Ethiopianness. So what are these things? How do they come into being? So until the arrival of Nietzschean genealogical methods, there is an idea that is firmly established in Western philosophy, from Descartes to Kant. This assumed existence of a natural sort of relationship between knowledge and the thing to be known. Nietzsche dislocated that idea, showing that, and I quote, there is no resemblance, no prior affinity between knowledge and the things needed to be known. Between knowledge and the world to be known, he said, there is as much difference between knowledge and human nature. So knowledge for Nietzsche is simply, and I quote, the outcome of the interplay, the encounter, the junction, the struggle, and the compromise between instincts, end of quote. Reinterpreting Nietzsche, Foucault says, and I quote, there is not a nature of knowledge, an essence of knowledge, of the universal condition of knowledge. Rather, that knowledge is always the historical and circumstantial result of conditions outside the domain of knowledge. So what we learn from this Nietzschean Foucauldian paradigm is that there is indeed no relationship between Ethiopia, the fixed geographical entity, and our knowledge of it. There is no resemblance or prior affinity or no internal relationship between the Ethiopia that existed as a concrete historical phenomenon and this very sacrosanct and divine knowledge that some have of it. And the same thing is true for Oromoness as well. And in fact, what we call Ethiopianness is primarily, though not exclusively, it's primarily the surface effects of the institutions, discourses, and practices that were dominated by Amharic-speaking Amhara elites. Now, when I say Amhara elite, and I use this in a very particular way, and I will come to that later, I don't really refer to territorial Amhara as Amhara elite, rather the deterritorial southern Amhara. So Ethiopianness and Oromoness are forms of nationalisms that are socially constituted and historically generated. both Ethiopianness and Oromoness form what they express and represent. They express and represent what they form. They are both forms of power and manifestations of power. They form and capture power, and the same power forms and captures them. So far from being natural and inevitable, as most of us seem to think, these are simply discursive constructions that are very much intertwined with questions of power and knowledge. They produce and circulate competing forms of knowledge and regimes of truths, and this knowledge and regimes of truths in turn constitute a field of power and function as an instrument of power. So it is basically in these two discourses that the antagonism between the Oromos and Amharas, or proponents of Oromoness and Ethiopianness, inscribes itself and projects its politics. It is through these discourses that the respective politics revitalizes itself. But this is not to suggest that there is some kind of symmetry between these two forms of nationalisms. Ethiopianness is a master discourse that represents, expresses grand historical narrative and hegemonic politics precisely because it was state politics. It's a state nationalism for a significant period of time. And that imperial frame of reference still continued to inaugurate and inform Ethiopian nationalism, despite the fact that that particular brand of nationalism is not really state nationalism today. But the imperial reference, the imperious attitude that is internal to that form of nationalism or to that strand of nationalism is still very present. Oromoness, on the other hand, is a subversive discourse. It's a discourse that is formulated to subvert and resist the hegemonic and oppressive currents of Ethiopianness or Ethiopians. So what I want to do now is sort of give you some ideas, some thoughts in terms of how these two different nationalisms manifest themselves and some of the claims that they make, and why I think those manifestations and the claims need to be critiqued, transformed, and disrupted if we are to really come together and have a productive conversation that gets us somewhere. First, so I'll first present three central claims and manifestations of Ethiopianness, and then I'll turn to Oromoness. Ethiopianness has always presented itself as a discourse of truths, a truth independent of power and politics, just like Americanness or Britishness or Englishness or Scottishness. It's an essentialist notion that claims to represent an absolute and timeless truth about the people and the polity that it speaks about. It claims to have a natural attribute, grounded in nature and in a stable foundation, a foundation that claims to have been constituted out of the totality of the social bodies and the practices that constitute the Ethiopian state, but in actuality reinforces simply the privilege of a particular ethnic group. Second, Ethiopianness presents itself via proponents of Ethiopian unity as an egalitarian, liberal, civilized, and self-evident moral category that is being threatened by narrow, parochial, nationalist, and ethnocentric forces. By using its power as a master signifier to define and name events, ideas, and things, Ethiopianness functions to silence alternative forms of self-expression and mobilization. So the teleological normativity that goes with Ethiopianness is strikingly similar to that which goes with Eurocentrism. Both Eurocentrism and Ethiopianness conceive themselves, and they conceive themselves and aggressively promote their values and symbols and their ways of being as universal, as something, values that are valid for all people and all nations, transculturally. Writing on this this European imperialism and international law, Tony Angi, a post-colonial scholar that we use in our course, some of my students will know this, and he says that whatever the contrasts and transitions may be, imperialism is constant. Okay. So the imperial project that provided the basis for colonialism in the 19th century has changed significantly, but certain things remained constant. International law rules, for example, remained constant. And you could say the same things about Ethiopian nationalism. It's the same logic that inaugurates and marks out the horizon of Ethiopian imagination. Precisely because of this imperialist tendency, Ethiopianist imagination unquestioningly romanticizes Ethiopianness and celebrates the often violent and complex project of Ethiopianization, modernization, and development. For pan-Ethiopian nationalists, Ethiopianization is a good thing because Ethiopianization is inclusive. Ethiopianization is a good thing because Ethiopianization is inclusive. Ethnocentric politics is bad because ethnocentric politics is exclusionary. It's not the terms of inclusion and the power relations that are created, suggested, sustained, and addressed by it. It's not the animating assumption that matters, but rather this unquestionable goodness of Ethiopianness, just like Europeanness or ideas of humanity, for example. Asha would know more about this. So like Europeanization before it, Ethiopianization is presented as a universal value that everyone wants to be included in. And in this particular case, the problem is not exclusion as such. The problem is exclusive inclusion. The problem is to be included as excluded. I'm the part of that Ethiopian social body. But when I enter that body, I have to change certain things. I can't enter as I am with all my baggage. Third, Ethiopianness presents itself as a universal category that uses its own professed universality and normativity to disguise its more intricate modes of exclusion. It's not a descriptive category, but it is evaluative. So to be truly Ethiopian, one needs to speak from within its analytic categories, use its vocabularies, deploy its moral standards, and effectively articulate claims within terms and frameworks that Ethiopianity understands, even if those are frameworks that do not properly acknowledge and recognize the other's identity. As such, Ethiopianness is a discourse that is at once inclusive and exclusive. It's a discourse, just like those discourses that operate in those terms, it's a discourse that commits an erasure of a very fundamental form against those discourses whose idiom is not signified within the master discourse. So in this way, Ethiopianness deploys universality to annihilate difference and coerces the other to submit itself to this idealized version of identity. However, there is really nothing inherently liberating or transformative about Ethiopianness and the kind of unitarian politics it projects. There are no prior legitimating conditions or metaphysical justifications that make its preferred forms of politics morally or ethically superior to identity politics. So there is nothing inherently good about that universalist form of politics and nothing inherently bad or evil about identity politics. And despite these universalist reverberations, Ethiopianness is not really a cosmopolitan ideal of the Kantian variety that regards all human beings as equal in dignity and worth. Ethiopianness is a deeply coded and hegemonic notion that amplifies and universalizes a very specific ethno-national culture and identity. And it has always been culturally specific. If you look at the symbols it forms and reflects, the tools, values it generates and circulates, the events and moments it celebrates and memorializes, all of these things reveal the particular ethnicity that is at the heart of this universal image. And more specifically, Ethiopianness consists in the Ethiopianization of Abyssinian culture, symbol and way of life. Not a reflection of universal attributes and symbols that are valid across that diverse nation, that diverse culture that constitutes the Ethiopian state, but the universalization of culturally specific values and interests. So what is often called Ethiopian nationalism or pan-Ethiopian nationalism is not really a non-exclusivist, tolerant civic nationalism with cosmopolitan aspiration, as its name suggests. It's Amhara nationalism, or Southern Amhara nationalism, to be more specific. So that's my reflection on Ethiopianness and what I consider to be some of the problems that are specific to that strand of nationalism. You know, that doesn't mean that every Amhara subscribes to my reading of that or to that particular strand of nationalism. But if you look at the broader view, that is how Ethiopianness manifests itself. Okay, now into Oromoness. I'm not sure if I said this at the beginning, but I personally have a significant stake in everything that I say here. So there is no claim to objectivity or neutrality in what I say. But I'm sure you also understand that neutrality and objectivity is not a condition for making scholarly, useful intervention. Okay. So, Oromoness. How does it manifest? How does Oromuma or Oromoness expresses itself? Now, the Oromo is a victim of a fundamental constitutive injustice, constitutive wrong, an injustice that deprived that community of what French philosopher Jacques Rancière calls the logos of politics. That is to say, the very conditions of visibility and audibility in the realm of politics. Theoretically, the Oromo is an integral part of an inclusive Ethiopian social body, but in practice, it forms what Rancière calls the part of those who have no part. What that means is that these are communities who can speak, but whose voices are heard as a noise, not as a discourse. Those who have bodies, but whose bodies are invisible and unrecognizable as speaking bodies or as speaking beings. And those whose claims and accounts of themselves are incapable of understanding. And they are often miscounted, and when they are counted, they are counted as a miscount. And Oromoness is a strategic knowledge formulated and deployed by this new Oromo subject who began to speak in history, a new subject who began to speak of rights, laws, justice, from his or her point of view, according to their lived experience as an Oromo. It was Hannah Arendt writing on the Jewish question who brilliantly articulated this cleavage between the universal and the particular. The universal that's propounded by the Ethiopian discourse and the particular that is propounded by the Oromos and Oromo nationalism. And here is what Arendt says, and I quote, "If one is attacked as a Jew, one must defend oneself as a Jew, not as a German, not as a world citizen, not as an upholder of the rights of man, or whatever. If an injustice is committed against you, precisely because of the particular identity or the particular social group that you belong to, your response must be on the basis of that identity which is the subject of an attack." So Oromoness basically operated along this line. It's a strategic knowledge of the past that deploys this knowledge as a counterpower to wrench the narrative from the hands of Ethiopianness. In some ways, it is a liberationist counter-history, if you like, interested in the struggle for the control of narratives and the means of narrative production. As a counter-knowledge and as counter-discourse, Oromoness marks the insurrection of subjugated historical knowledges of the Oromo past, a discourse that reactivates those local knowledges of subjugation and conquest, knowledges that are local and regional but present in the system's functional ensembles. Precisely because of their presence in the system's functional ensembles, they are incapable of anonymity. They exist, right, but they don't have the kind of visibility that state discourse has. This knowledge did not emerge with the birth of what is called the Kobe generation, but goes back to a much earlier date. That is not a single date. And that cannot be neatly pinned down to a single subversive moment or event. The emergence of the Kobe generation is a key turning point in a long history of re-narration and retelling, but one that seems to have reinvigorated the self-naming and marked a specific turn on Oromo politics. So this is the emergence of this new Oromo subject in history, a subject that turns to history to find resources for struggle. Okay. One that engages in a strategic rewriting and a re-narration of the past as an alternative vista of knowledge production and truth generation. You have to produce your own truths in order for your voice and your claims to find meaning in the political sphere. And that, I think, in my reading at least, is what is going on. So against this continuity and glorious genealogy of 3,000 years in which the Ethiopianist discourse flaunts itself, Oromonas rejects that we have such a solemn continuity behind us. It speaks of discontinuity, it speaks of contingency, it speaks of complexity. And in this, I think, it's a resistant discourse, a discourse that addresses itself not only to changing the status quo and the distribution of power that exists at the moment, but also to decolonizing the inner Oromo subjectivity. Okay. So when you hear, for example, certain very extreme views on that side of politics, at least in my reading, they have a very particular objective, not necessarily changing the status quo, not necessarily creating a space for people to come together and have a conversation that leads to some kind of understanding, but decolonizing the mind. So let me just now sort of try and draw the two trends together, or the two frames together. They have, as I said, their own manifestations, their own claims. But neither Ethiopianness nor Oromonas can claim an a priori superiority by virtue of normative qualities that are inherent to their constitutive logic. For these are both historically generated and socially constructed. For that simple reason, they have no inherent qualities to be necessarily good or necessarily evil. Why is this important? This is important because, at least in conversations that I have attended, there is a view that ethno-national politics is somewhat inhuman. It is somewhat uncivilized. So when you have that view that sort of presents a particular form of nationalism as somewhat divine, that cannot be a conversation starter. And I think it's precisely for this reason that it is important to make that point. So these are both historically generated and socially constructed. Precisely for that reason, they cannot be inherently good or inherently bad. Ethiopianness, as I said, has been state discourse for over a century. And depending on your reading of history or which history you accept, it has not become an inclusive and egalitarian form of nationalism. Oromonas, as I said, is a subversive discourse, subversive nationalism, and there is no guarantee that it will achieve these intended goals of realizing an egalitarian and a just society. There's simply no guarantee. You can claim whatever you like, but there is no guarantee. And its ability to do so rests on a host of unforeseeable variables that cannot be fully anticipated in advance. And we know of several countries in the region in which those claims were made, but they turned out to be even worse in certain cases. And I think one of the central weaknesses of Oromuma or Oromonas is the fact that it sort of solely defined itself vis-a-vis the Ethiopianist discourse. Yeah. In my view, a little too much. And it has not been able to make a positive case for Ethiopia. It sort of abandoned the idea of Ethiopia, basically. There might be reasons for understanding how that came into being, particularly looking back to the 1930s, 1970s, but things have significantly changed at the moment, and it's important, I think, for that group to reconsider that view. It's important that they make a very positive vision for Ethiopia. So between this universality that is claimed by Ethiopianness and the particularity that characterizes Oromonas, there is a fundamental opposition. Oromo and Amhara elites have been arguing over the meaning and content of national unity for the last two decades. While mainstream Amhara politicians insist on national unity as a condition for collaboration with Oromo nationalists, Oromos reject demands for national unity on the basis that there have not been a set of shared democratic values or principles and ideas that would serve as a uniting basis for the two to come together. whatever common social cultural values existed, the nationalists respond, those values did not emerge out of a relationship of equality and dignity. And therefore, they cannot be the starting point for a new vision of a democratic Ethiopia. And I think this is one of the many reasons why every attempt at a meaningful conversation and a dialogue between Oromos and Amharas usually end up in a spectacular failure before they even get to the key things that need to be discussed. And for any struggle to yield a transformative, progressive change, you don't just want change, but you want a progressive change, Ethiopian politics needs a paradigm shift. It must confront head-on this ever-present and unsettling Ethiopia-Oromia, Ethiopian-ness, Oromo-ness divide that sort of runs through the Ethiopian social body, dividing it into binary structure along Oromia-Ethiopia divide. This is a foundational problem, what Derrida calls an apariah, for this is really an issue that goes to the heart of the we, right? The we that is presumed by the state, but it is a deeply contested category, a we that never actually existed. As I described earlier, what is presented as the we, as if it comprises various ethnic groups in the country, there are more than 80, is a very particular ethno-national culture. So we speak as a we, but that we doesn't really exist. It's precisely for that reason that we need to find some kind of ethical consensus, moral consensus, in terms of reconstituting that we as a new. Now, some of these debates are historical, and they are epistemic in nature, and require a robust and inclusive engagement, an engagement that cannot actually be done from abroad by people like us here in London and at the LSE. We need a pluralistic, democratic public space that sustains epistemic battles, debates, engagements, confrontations, even with people whose views we find extremely revolting and intolerable. But that is possible only within a democratic Ethiopia, where you have the opportunity to engage and participate everyone else. And you can't have that kind of dialogue, that kind of conversation from abroad. And I think that's why the project of democratizing Ethiopia actually comes first in order to flesh out, sort out these historic differences, these historic disagreements. And only within a democratic Ethiopia can we have these debates in which we can move towards some kind of epistemic consensus. And when we do that, we'll be able to make these discourses and practices aware of the margins they conceal and the violence they make possible. Remember, we may never agree on everything, but it is possible to have some kind of consensus on certain things. And there are a number of things, a number of experiments out there that can be tried in terms of bringing people together. So we can debate the past as much as we like, but I think right now we can identify broadly shared cultural, demographic, and territorial conditions that make dialogue and collective action absolutely necessary. But if these shared values are not strong enough ties for Oromos and Amharas to come together and resist this perverse oppression, which actually thrives on the back of this antagonism, as I said, there is one, I think, other thing that unites these two groups. And this is the fact that they are both members of the community of the oppressed and the community of the misgoverned. That fact alone, a fact that doesn't depend on any prior event of belonging, conferral, or relations, right, that alone imposes on us both a right and a duty of solidarity. And the risks of not working together are great for both sides. And the bickering and rivalry not only prolongs ongoing oppression, it risks changing the facts on the ground and permanently channels struggles along undesirable paths. And that would deprive us of the opportunity to explore more democratic and representative alternatives. So if there is nothing inherent or nothing natural about the kinds of knowledges and truths, right, of both Ethiopiawinnet and Oromoness, if they are all discursive constructions that came into being through the interplay of various modalities of power, then the prevailing notion, the existing notion of Ethiopianness and Oromoness, are not indispensable. It is possible to reconfigure, reconstruct these discourses and create a better Ethiopia in which everyone's identity, culture, subjecthood, genres of discourse are manifest it and find expression. Now, let me try and link this to more current events. Now, the violent response of the ruling party to both the Oromo and Amhara protests actually brought into a sharp focus the shared vulnerability of the oppressed Ethiopian, threatening to expose the porous nature of the boundaries and fault lines that both unites and divides the Oromos and the Amharas. As the violence of the state intensifies in scale and scope, the former ARC force sets their mutual rivalry aside and came together against the violence of the state. So as you can see here on this picture, an extraordinary groundswell of solidarity action is emerging at all levels. And precisely as a result of this mutual experience of suffering and the intense collective emotions generated by recent killings. For those of you who are not up to date with the situation in Ethiopia, Oromos have been protesting since November of 2015. The Amharas joined the protest sometimes around April. So far, government security forces have killed over 500 people. This is a conservative estimate from Human Rights Watch. Activists on the ground put this figure at significantly higher number. So just to give you an idea. So there is this movement that is mobilizing a new generation of young people that are consolidating around broad-based collective struggles. We are all Oromos. I'm not Oromo, but I stand with my Oromo brothers. Amhara is ours. Oromo is ours. The blood flowing in Oromia is ours. Our blood too. These are just some of the many expressions of solidarity that we saw during these rallies. And this is between people who never saw eye to eye, always considered one another as adversaries, politically. Okay. And these words usually go unnoticed, but these are really not just words. They are actions that exist as words. These are actions that threaten to unsettle us, to destabilize the governing means of the prevailing order. It's that means, that narrative that I told you earlier, which is created to set the two apart and perpetuate the domination of a particular ethnic group. These are words that go beyond the repressive and divisive discourse of the state to create conditions for collective politics, for new forms of alliances and coalitions. In short, these are gestures that seek to imagine and perceive a different kind of world and new forms of futures for the two people. Moreover, this act of speaking together and grieving together produced a plural collective, a collective that is more determined than ever to congregate with one another, to appear with, mourn with, and endure with a diverse group of people. Flags and symbols that are seen by Oromos and Amharas as their respective symbols of resistance began to appear together in protest rallies in opposition to the violence of the state, bringing together symbols that are inscribed in the Ethiopian social and political imaginary as somewhat antithetical and absolutely irreconcilable. The one to the left is symbol of the Oromo symbol of resistance. This is the Ethiopian symbol of resistance, Ethiopian as I described it. And these are two discourses that were sort of inscribed in our imaginary as somewhat antithetical, two discourses that never come together, that never speak to one another. And strikingly, they came together. So this simple gesture of solidarity unleashed the force of community and actually eviscerated the impregnable bastion of lies that for far too long supplied the system's remarkable resilience in that country. So a regime that seemed invincible began to tremble, with officials expressing their disgust and fury and outrage at the sight of these two symbols together and the expression of solidarity between Amharas and Oromos. I'm sure most Ethiopians have seen Ethiopia's government communication minister, Getachew Reda, expressing frustration at the solidarity being expressed between these two groups. And I have, let me just play this clip very, very quickly. It's an Amharic, and I'll translate the gist of the content.
Because
Okay, so what he's saying essentially is that, first of all, you know, the gestures that you see for Ethiopians is very clear, but it's a very angry gesture. He's outraged by the fact that these two groups have been able to come together and congregate in one place, speak to one another. And he's a representative of a government that represents only 6% of that country. Now, when I say it's a government that represents 6%, I don't really believe personally that TPLF represents the Tigray people. I don't think TPLF represents the Tigray people any more than EPRDF represents the Ethiopian people, generally, in my view. But in any case, regardless of how you read that relationship, he is a core member of the TPLF, the party that controls pretty much every aspect of public life in that country, from the economy to politics, military, security, and so on and so forth. And what he is saying is that the fact that these two groups, Amaras and the Oromos, are coming together against the government is evidence that the government is not doing enough. The government is not really working hard. What is it that is lacking? They are not very good in terms of driving these wedges of division between these two groups. And that is essentially how the system maintains itself. To say that the government has not done enough in terms of keeping these two larger groups apart is simply, I think, to state that one of the things on the basis of which that system thrives is the policy of divide and rule. We are not sufficiently dividing and ruling. That is what he's trying to say. So this insistence of the government on these divisive notions is, I think, one of the reasons why solidarity is becoming such a significant notion. It seems to me that the two groups now increasingly see solidarity as a foundational principle underpinning their collective struggle for emancipatory change. There was a recent memorandum of understanding that was signed between two political parties. Regardless of what you think of those political parties, they come from these two different spectrums. There are certain tenets of solidarity that were entrenched in that memorandum of understanding. But these acts of solidarity, right, that we are talking about must be grounded in some basic principles, principles over which there can be reasonable agreements between the parties. So I want to put out there certain ideas, I think, that will form the basis for what I call inter-ethnic, translocal solidarity. So the content of solidarity, obviously, is not self-evident, particularly when it comes to a diverse and highly fractious society such as Ethiopia. Of course, despite obvious contradictions that inevitably arise out of constructing ethically appealing normative possibilities for multi-ethnic communities such as Ethiopia, trans-ethnic solidarity is not about oneness, and it's not about making everyone essentially the same. Nor it is about crippling diversity or making anyone's identity or culture politically irrelevant or arbitrary. Solidarity is about building cross-cultural understanding, tolerance, respect, and acceptance to deal with crises of unprecedented magnitude. As a moral ideal and a cosmopolitan obligation, solidarity demands that we take into account not only our needs and preferences, but also the needs and preferences of those that are ineradicably different from us. It's a principle of action and collaboration that unlocks the energy of the collective, of the inter-ethnic community, to create new alliances and opportunity structures, thereby forming new sources of optimism for a more positive future. It requires shared commitment to ideals of democracy, basic human rights, government transparency, accountability, and the other liberal ideals. This is particularly so when diversity is co-opted by a particular constellation of power, as in Ethiopia, for example. So solidarity can help us deal with the excesses of diversity through institutions that promote peaceful coexistence, equal partnership, something we lack in Ethiopia, equitable sharing of benefits and burdens. It is possible to build durable social and institutional structures on the basis of ties that are not very tightly bound to one particular culture or identity. There is strength in weak ties, and the challenge is to imagine the boundaries within which solidarity emerges out of weak ties. And I think only that kind of solidarity can confront the many challenges the country faces and deals with the problem of diversity. But our task is not to force a cosmopolitan vision of the world on nationalists or the other way around. It's rather to create space for collective politics. Collective politics understood, and I am quoting from Sara Ahmed here, collective politics understood as a politics based not on the possibility that we might be reconciled, but on learning to live with the impossibility of reconciliation, or learning to live that we live with and besides each other, and yet we are not one. I must say that this is a very pessimistic formulation of the problem. I think we could do better in Ethiopia, but we can use this as a baseline, right? To live side by side, knowing that we can never be the same, that we are still different from one another. Okay, so by way of conclusion, I think only within a framework that sort of transcends the horizon of present arrangements and constellations, and one that views Ethiopia, and this is really important, one that views Ethiopia as a project of becoming, a project that is unfolding. It's only within this framework that it is possible to imagine the emergence of a pluralistic, resilient, inclusive, and democratic polity. Ethiopia is not something that is already done and over. It's a state. It's a polity. It constitutes people, geographies, and ideas. But the most important thing is the idea bit, which I've been talking about. And these ideas are not set in stone. They can be reformulated, reconstructed, and transformed. And I think this framework would allow us to transform these shared grievances that brought us together into a shared vision and work towards Ethiopianness in which, now I'm going to name names and specific places so most people outside Ethiopia wouldn't know this, right? We can work towards an Ethiopianness in which an Afari from Afar, a Tigrayan from Aksum, a Dinka from Gambela, for example, a Somali from Hargeisa, an Amhara from Gojam, or an Oromo from Gincy, you know, I can't name all the other 80-plus ethnic groups. All of this can come together and create an Ethiopia in which their identities, their culture, their ways of being and acting are reflected. And I think that is possible. All we need is the patience to come together, have that difficult, complicated conversation, which leads us to some kind of understanding. So what we need is imagination. If we have that, I think the challenges can be overcome. Thank you.